Hi, it's Lynn Rossetto Casper, and you're listening to The Splendid Table, the show for people who love to eat. Our program is produced by Minnesota Public Radio and brought to you by SuperTarget. Well, today it's back to an era when the seduction supper was an art form. Art historian Carolyn Young is author of Apples of Gold in Settings of Silver, Stories of Dinner as a Work of Art. She takes us to dinner with the master, Casanova. The time is 1753, the place is Venice, and his dining companion might shock you. Food expert Sally Schneider tells us all about the Meyer Lemon. We have a guide to Chicago, the great neighborhoods for eating out. It's from William Rice. He's the food and wine columnist for the Chicago Tribune. Then it's the story of growing up Rodale. That's the legendary family of organic pioneers. And as always, in the second half of the show, we're going to be opening the lines for your calls. You can reach us at 800-537-5252. So let's get things started with Jane and Michael Stern. They write the Road Food column in Gourmet magazine. Hey, Jane, Michael, so what's the latest with you two?
Well, actually, we were traveling around with our friend George, who lives in Connecticut with us, and he grew up in Brooklyn, and he said, we have never tasted great Italian-American food until we went to Coney Island and went to a place called Gargiulio's, which has been there since George was a little boy. And
long before George was a little boy.
How long has it been?
Gargiulo's opened in 1907, when going to Coney Island was a kind of great, festive, and kind of maybe even fancy event. Coney Island has changed a little bit since then. Gargiulo's has not. It's still a place to eat very deluxe Italian-American food in the company of people who really appreciate it.
Well, I do think Gargiulio's has changed a little bit because George said when he was a little boy growing up in the 50s and he would go there with his family, there was a papier-mâché octopus that was so big it took up the entire ceiling of the restaurant.
The octopus is gone.
What a nice idea, eating under an octopus. I like this.
But Gargiulio's is a little island of not only normalcy, but of haute cuisine in the middle of Coney Island, which is kind of a very scary, decrepit wreck. I mean, especially at night, Michael and I were driving around, and we saw one block from Gargiulio's. There's still a freak show in Coney Island with the human blockhead and an elastic boy and, you know, all of this kind of surreal Fellini-esque landscape. But if you go into Gargiulio's, you would never sort of know that Coney Island is strange.
So what is the food like?
Well, it's real Italian-American, all kinds of pastas. I mean, with a dozen different sauces. My favorite sauce was one that I had never seen before, white bolognese sauce. Now, George said this is the best because you get your meat and your Alfredo in one sauce. It's about 20,000 calories per plate, but is it good. And the noodles, perfectly cooked. I mean, really al dente. I mean, these are cooked by somebody who knows how to cook Italian food.
And being just probably 20 feet from the Atlantic Ocean, lobster is a big thing at this restaurant. And we had a wonderful lobster tail Fra Diavolo, which I just love. It was a big, fresh lobster tail, beautifully spiced in a hot tomato sauce.
Mm. So is the place very elegant? I mean, do you dress to go there?
Well, you know, it's funny. It is very elegant, but the people who were eating there were dressed very casually. We went on a Saturday night. There were a lot of families, a lot of little kids.
The staff is dressed in tuxedos.
The staff is in tuxedos, and the room is, you know, crystal chandeliers and you know, all of this very fancy stuff. But there were people there in T-shirts. I mean, it's kind of
shoes, no service, I'm sure. I mean, it's not like you have to dress up, but neither do people go sloppy to Gargiulo's.
Well, it sounds like pure Americana in that regard.
It is pure Americana. And what's best is they have valet parking right outside, so you don't ever have to walk on the streets outside.
You don't have to deal with the freak show down the street.
Right.
So this is the home of the Parmigiana and the red sauce.
The veal Sorrentino, the veal Milanese, the pasta fagioli. I mean, it's really great Italian-American food.
Right. Baked clams, manicotti. I mean, it's truly Italian American, kind of the level of food that you see people eating in Martin Scorsese movies, which to me always looks delicious.
And plenty of it too.
Like huge antipasties.
Hey guys, thank you.
You're
Bye,
welcome, Lynn.
If you're feeling fancy free, come wander to the world with me. And any place we chance to be will be our rendezvous. Two for the road.
Jane and Michael Stern have updated their classic guidebook, Road Food. Now, you hear them here every week, but you can get their food finds anytime. Just go to the website, splendidtable.org. And while you're there, take a look at our weekly newsletter. It's called Weeknight Kitchen. Every week there's a new recipe, tips on techniques, and what's good in the market. It's all geared to making weeknight cooking easier for us. And it's free. So register online, splendidtable.org. Writer Sally Schneider is one of the few people I know who can make voluptuous and good for you happen on the same plate. She's always discovering ways to tease the best out of an ingredient and yet keep the food healthy. Her book is A New Way to Cook, and she comes by often to visit. Hey, Sally, welcome back.
Thanks, Lynn.
What have you been working with?
I'm working with what I think is a little bit of gold that is in the supermarket this time of year when we only have the same old ingredients, and that is Meyer lemons. These are an extraordinary kind of lemon. Actually, I don't even want to call them a lemon because they have such an intensely beautiful perfume that's really like a cross between tangerine and lemon, and the flesh itself is much sweeter. They originally came from China, and now they're being cultivated in California, and they are in the supermarkets. And I use them not only in desserts, which seem obvious, but in lots of savory dishes.
So like what?
First and foremost, the juice is fabulous to serve as a cocktail, a non-alcoholic cocktail. I have a friend that juices a great deal of lemons and freezes it. And when people come over, she just defrosts it and serves it over ice, sweetened lightly if necessary, depending on the lemon. And it is utterly beautiful and exotic and refreshing. I personally love the zest of the lemon. I strip it off with a vegetable peeler and cut it into thin slivers, and then I begin to use it to literally perk up all kinds of dishes. For example, grated salads made of root vegetables like celery root, parsnip, have these wonderful kind of spicy flavors that go wonderfully with the lemon zest, dressed with nut oils and apples, that sort of thing. Mm. It's great in slaws, mm-hmm. potato salad. Warm, I toss it with steamed green beans that I've coated with a little brown butter and tossed with hazelnuts. It's a great little hit of flavor in cooked dried beans, in mashed pureed root vegetables. You know those risottos and pastas made with regular lemons?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Meyer lemon is fabulous with it and with Parmigiano. So these are all savory ways. Now, bear in mind, if you want to use it in place of a regular lemon, you have to remember it's sweeter and it won't have that acidity. So you can't use it for that acid hit of a regular lemon. You're really using it for its aromatic qualities. It makes a fabulous vinaigrette. You can just mix the juice with hazelnut or extra virgin olive oil and salt and pepper. If you separate the sections and put it in that vinaigrette, you have a fabulous sauce for fish, very much like ones done in the south of France. Then in terms of desserts, my favorite thing is a Meyer lemon curd. But I make my lemon curd without butter, which is kind of heretical, because I've always found those curds too heavy. So I make it with eggs and egg yolks and sugar and the lemon juice and some of the zest. And it makes this very ethereal, almost like a custard, but even lighter. And that can be the filling for a tart shell with a little whipped creme fraiche. You can put sliced mangoes on it or bananas, or if you find some great berries, it is totally divine. Then, of course, that zest again and little bits of the flesh go wonderfully with apples and pears and all the winter fruits, whether we want to serve them as apple sauces or sauces for savory foods and roasts or in desserts and tarts.
Now, what's the season on the Meyer lemon?
The season starts in November and really picks up steam in December and January and February and then begins to decline in March. So we have them for a good amount of time.
Well, it sounds like what I should do is buy a whole ton of them and then freeze the zest and freeze the juice and just go to town all year. Thanks a lot.
You're welcome, Lynn.
Sally Schneider is author of A New Way to Cook, and she left us with her recipe for that Meyer lemon curd. You can find it on the website, splendidtable.org. Now, there's another exotic that is in prime shape right now. It's the blood orange. Now, talk about gorgeous. These babies glow like oranges dipped in liquid rubies. Now, when you buy them, remember this. The more dark dappling on the skin, the more color inside in their flesh, and the more distinctive their taste. Now, at their best, they taste like extra rich orange mixed with raspberries. The tastiest type of blood orange, for my money, is the purple-toned Moro variety. But most markets don't label the blood oranges by variety, so we have to take what we can get. Now, some of them can kind of be tart sweet, and some very sweet. Any blood orange makes stunning fresh-squeezed juice. And in France, I saw a chef sauté a salmon in a little bit of butter, and then he turned the pan juices into a sauce by adding about a cup of fresh-squeezed blood orange juice and boiling it down, oh, by about half. And then he swirled in a little bit of butter. Now, just imagine this. Garnet-colored sauce over pink salmon. Who could resist? But if you're going to go out and buy a blood orange, I think you should do something really simple with it to show it off. And the best thing I know is a Sicilian orange salad. It's slices of the orange with red onion and olives and some navel oranges in for contrast. We've got the recipe on the website, Blood Orange Sicilian Salad, splendidtable.org. Coming up, back to the old days when romance was high art, the man who challenged better living through chemistry, and open lines for your calls. You can reach us at 800-537-5252. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table, produced by Minnesota Public Radio and distributed by PRI. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is The Splendid Table, the show about life's appetites. The Splendid Table is brought to you by SuperTarget, a grocery store and Target store all in one. In addition to a complete Target store, SuperTarget features a bakery, deli, fresh produce, meats, and seafood. To find the SuperTarget nearest you, you can visit them online at Target.com. Something seasonal, a seduction. With the master, the infamous Casanova. The scene is Venice, the time is 1753, and our guide is Carolyn Young, art historian and antiques expert on the history of the table. Now, Carolyn has been researching how revealing a meal can be. Her new book is Apples of Gold in Settings of Silver, Stories of Dinner as a Work of Art. Carolyn Young, welcome.
Thank you. I'm delighted to be here.
Well, Carolyn, you're a historian. Why did you choose the dinner as your sort of lens into the past?
Well, the dinner is where all five senses come together, and most importantly, people come together. So really at the table, you can see the porcelain, the silver, the glass, but then the music, what are they eating? What are they talking about? And you see all of the arts together, and you see how people behave and what the motif is.
Well, you've got so many meals in the book. I mean, you've got a surrealistic picnic from the 1930s. You've got monks dining with God. I think it's in the 11th or 12th century. You've got a study mm-hmm. in gluttony. But considering the time of year this is, I'd like to focus on your seduction chapter, Casanova's Intimate Supper.
So, well, it's a timeless theme.
That it is. Who was Casanova?
Well, Casanova, you know, who we think of as almost a noun, or we describe people as a Casanova, was, you know, an adventurer, real man, the son of commedia dell'arte characters. And in this age of artifice, he was sort of the master at creating himself and creating this life of adventure and gambling and pleasure seeking, yet always with a very charming, charming spirit.
Well, what exactly drove him? I mean, he's famous for his sexual adventures, but what was the sort of raison d'etre?
And he says it right away. We know about Casanova because he wrote a 12-volume autobiography, which goes on and on and on, recounting his adventures. Well, and they are so outrageous that for a long time people thought they were a hoax, that perhaps Stendhal had written them. But in fact, historians have shown that he was a real man and he lived. And he says right away in the preface to his autobiography that cultivating pleasure is what has been the primary motivation of his life. And he says it right there. It's as much a wonderful wine or a delicious dish, you know, salt cod or macaroni by a Neapolitan cook, as much as a beautiful woman. And now to enjoy those all together is just heaven.
So you tell a story about a specific night of seduction with Casanova, but he's not the seducer. Can you tell us about that?
Well, no, he's not the seducer. It takes place in November 1753, and in fact, he's yearning for his previous lover has been locked away by her father, probably very wisely, into a convent. And the father said, you can't marry her unless you are loyal for 4 years. So Casanova keeps going to the mass at the convent to try to see his lover from behind the screen. And one day as he's leaving, this letter is mysteriously tossed at his feet, and it is an absolutely outrageous invitation for him to meet with a feisty young nun who has been observing him and would like to meet him for dinner.
And what happens?
Well, in fact, she gives him three offers. It's kind of like Aladdin, you know, you get three wishes. And the first is, should he wish, he can come to the convent with someone who he doesn't know, so he doesn't have to give his name and just observe her. The second, more outrageous one, is to actually join him at a casino, which at the time means a small place where you would gamble, but a private apartment where you would gamble or have seductive affairs. And this nun says, oh, I'll meet you at a casino in Murano, and we can have dinner. Or you can leave after 15 minutes. And the third proposal is that she will leave the convent and meet him at any spot of his choice in Venice to sup with him.
So which one does he choose?
Well, he's cautious because, you know, of course he wants to go for all three. But what if it's a hoax? You know, what if she's just old and ugly and horrible? So he starts with the first choice, and he goes with this countess and sees that this is absolutely the most exquisite young woman, and she seems very sophisticated. Her letter is also written in French on beautiful paper and sealed with a gold seal. So he knows that she's very sophisticated. And, of course, as soon as he sees her, he's just, you know, dying to meet her for supper. And eventually they do meet for dinner. And he goes off into the night, masked in Venice, in the gondola, alone with a single candle to meet her at this casino, and slips the key that she's given him into the door, goes through the antechamber. It's all gilded and mirrored and lit with candles, and finds her dressed like Madame de Pompadour, this mistress of the king herself. She's not a nun anymore. She's a beautiful French lady of the court.
And they, what does she serve him?
Well, right away, not only does he notice that the furnishings are distinctively French, but he, as soon as he tastes the first bite, says the chef must be French. And it is, in fact, served to them. There is a serving woman who, you know, is bound to guard the secret of this illicit meal to the grave, and she carries it in. So they don't eat in the dining room. It's a small apartment, and it's sort of casually set up. But it's, of course, meticulously planned ahead of time. So there's a little serving dishes at the side, and then they're at their sofa having their meal. At the end of which, M.M. in her beautiful silk ruffled gown gets up. This is the nun. The nun gets up and goes over to the other table, and she actually tosses the salad herself very charmingly. And this is the age in which this is a great fashion in the French court for aristocrats to play at cooking, to play at being the servant. And it's a yearning for simplicity, and it's very charming and very almost like a geisha girl.
So does the evening end in the bedroom?
Well, in fact, for this dinner of seduction, the dining room transforms into a bedroom. And there's a bit of lingering after dinner, and you know, they drink lots of wine, burgundy, he says, and champagne for gaiety. And then, you know, Casanova becomes, quote, insistent. And she's playing hard to get a little bit now that she's lured him into her den. But she suggests that they should sleep right there in their clothes, which Casanova complains vehemently against, and says, well, we'll be uncomfortable here on the sofa sleeping in our clothes. And all of a sudden she gets up and, with a mechanical device, there's lots of mechanical furniture in this age, transforms this little sofa into a bed, complete with all its bedclothes.
Well, Carolyn, whole new take for all of us on seduction. Thank you.
Pleasure. Thank you.
Art historian Carolyn Young lectures on dining history at Sotheby's Institute of Art and is author of Apples of Gold in Settings of Silver, Stories of Dinner as a Work of Art. Chicago is a food town of the first order. But how do you define a food town? Well, of course, there's got to be the exceptional upscale restaurants. But a real food town has great ethnic and local foods. You know, the kind of places that you can afford to eat several times a week and you walk out of them with a smile on your face. Now, to find those places, you need an insider. And for Chicago, well, how about nothing less than the food and wine columnist of the Chicago Tribune? He is William Rice, a man who spent the better part of his life working in food, and he's just done a story for Gourmet Magazine on eating in Chicago. Bill, welcome.
Thank you, Lynn.
So, Bill, what's Chicago like for the diner? I mean, what typifies it?
Well, I think you start out with the idea that the person that goes to a restaurant in Chicago is going because she or he are truly hungry. And they really expect to eat, and they expect to get good portions of recognizable food.
So one does not make the scene when one goes out in Chicago?
No. There is a scene here and there, but it moves quite a bit. And the places that stay around and become legendary are very much straightforward and well done. What's changed, I think, most in the last few years is that there's much more recognition of what is quality and where to get it.
Now, you talk about neighborhoods in this piece, and they strike me as neighborhoods that, as a visitor, I may never find on my own. But is there a place you'd like us to focus?
Well, the place that seems to have come to the fore is an area called Andersonville, which is not that far off the lake. It's north of the downtown area, and I think you're quite right. Unless you were of Swedish extraction and were coming for an annual celebration of some sort, it's unlikely as an out-of-towner you'd go there. It's north of Wrigley Field, and most people seem to get to Wrigley Field and stop.
Mm-hmm.
But what's truly curious, of course, is that Andersonville, as you might suspect, is Swedish, Scandinavian clientele, except some of the great restaurants up there these days are a Mideastern grocery store, a Turkish bakery, a Japanese restaurant, a Korean restaurant. The ethnic mix is truly at work. The Mixmaster is at work in Chicago.
But can I come to Andersonville and actually have Scandinavian food?
You can. It's almost a dollhouse. There's this cute small restaurant called Svea, S-V-E-A, on North Clark Street.
Mm-hmm.
And they have a number of Swedish specialties still on the menu. And across the street is a wonderful gourmet food store called Wickstrom's. And they have the sardines and the dark bread and the cheeses and things that one associates with Scandinavian eating.
Okay, so I can do Japanese food, I can do Scandinavian food in
Andersonville.
And
in between a little Korean, all within a block or so of one another. And to give away the punchline of this story, the other food spot up there that's worth seeking out is called Fido's Food Fair. And it's party food for dogs.
Is it a restaurant or is it a takeout operation?
They do have, for the dogs that can't wait, they do have a couple of little table spaces where the dogs can eat right away.
Any other areas of town that I could get a cab to and then focus on?
Well, I think that the area that's really quite intriguing and in the sense that it's changed so much is really just west of the Loop area. It's called the West Side or River West, and there you find a very nice mix of newfangled modern restaurants. The area has become quite fashionable. It's along Randolph Street. And among the newer places is a restaurant called Blackbird, which is a modern American, bright and loud but wonderful food of chef named Paul Cahan. And then just west of there is a French restaurant called Marché. Across the street is a restaurant called Red Light, which is Asian fusion, I guess we'll call it.
Mm-hmm.
Then a steakhouse. And then the next block, Sushi Wabi, which is, as it sounds, a place to go for sushi. And then a little further out, a French place called La Sardine, small, as you might think. And,
right.
And a very nice neighborhood restaurant called Ina's, which is just out of the 40s is wonderful cakes and breakfast foods and just a fun place to go in the neighborhoods there at lunch, eating sandwiches and soup and talking. And as I say, you could turn the clock back 40 or 50 years.
Hal Bill, it sounds like the neighborhoods are flourishing. Hey, thanks a lot.
Oh, it's been my pleasure, Lynn.
Bill Rice describes himself as the hungriest man in America. And it's a good thing, since he's the food and wine columnist for the Chicago Tribune. His article on dining in Chicago appeared in the February 2003 issue of Gourmet. Every field has its pioneers, people who see things way before the rest of us. Consider the new national organic standards. The seeds for that were planted over a half century ago. Maria Rodale remembers her grandfather.
Last October, a seed that my grandfather planted 60 years ago finally came to fruition. You can now find the USDA Certified Organic Seal on your favorite organic fruits, vegetables, and packaged foods. It's been a long time coming. It's taken incredible patience and persistence. Social change always does. Here's how it happened. In 1940, when my grandfather, J.I. Rodale, introduced the concept of organic, a healthier, chemical-free method of farming, most Americans believed the chemicals could solve all their problems. To think differently was considered almost unpatriotic. My grandfather was called a quack by the American Medical Association, sued by the Federal Trade Commission, and barely welcomed in polite society. He certainly wasn't invited to join the local country club. After all, establishment types said, what could a Jewish certified public accountant from the Lower East Side of Manhattan know about agriculture and science? He had no university degrees, no special expertise in these fields. But J.I. believed in organic with all his heart and his self-educated brain. Rather than bend to the pressures of his detractors, he did what many obsessed entrepreneurs do. He launched a magazine, Organic Farming and Gardening, to get his ideas out there. That was just the beginning. He traveled the world seeking out like-minded souls. He visited Georgia O'Keeffe's Organic Garden in the 60s. He went to England to swap ideas with some of the pioneers of natural soil science. Back at home, he opened his farm to the public so that people could see how this new method worked. Devotees and hippies started to show up at our kitchen door in droves. Sometimes they'd peek through our windows while we were eating dinner. All those VW hippie vans looked pretty funny parked next to my grandfather's purple Cadillac. Organic was not an ego trip for J.I., it was a mission. So when people like Rachel Carson and Francis Moore LePay began talking about the dangers of chemical agriculture, he promoted their ideas too. J.I. knew that the more brains on the case meant a greater likelihood of success. By the early 70s, organic had become a popular idea. The New York Times magazine pronounced my grandfather the guru of the organic food cult. He was invited on the Dick Cavett Show, where he died of a heart attack at the end of the interview. My theory is that after a lifetime of fighting for acceptance, he was overcome when it finally came to him. Fortunately, he had a son, my father Robert, to continue his work. My father launched the first study to compare organic to conventional agriculture. When the positive results started coming in, and they're still coming in, the detractors were forced to pay attention. My father would be a happy man this year. Unfortunately, he died in a car accident in Moscow while starting a magazine on organic farming and gardening for the beleaguered Soviets back in 1990. No one said this would be easy. It took 30 years of grassroots activism and 10 years of government committee meetings and infighting, my idea of hell, to reach this milestone. Many people have worked hard to bring this change about. All Americans will share in its benefits, and of course it's not over. Agriculture that relies on chemicals and genetically modified organisms, GMOs, is still the most widely practiced form of farming in America. Yet none of us should feel powerless. We really can make a difference. Believe it or not, the healthy future of this planet is in our hands, at our local supermarkets. Vote with your dollars and keep buying organic.
For the sake of momentum, I've allowed my fears to get larger than life, and it's brought me to my current agenda, where abundance and that fulfillment has yet to arrive. And I know life is getting shorter.
Maria Rodale is founding editor of Organic Style magazine. Well, it's time for our weekly trivia challenge. Now, this one's for retro buffs. Which decade brought us the first salad bar, the first Have It Your Way ad, and the first Starbucks? We're going to have that answer in a moment, and we're going to be opening the lines for your calls. You can reach us at 800-537-5252. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table, produced by Minnesota Public Radio and distributed by Public Radio International.
I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is The Splendid Table, the show for people who love to eat. The Splendid Table is supported by Super Target, offering ingredients for your favorite recipes from real semolina brass-cut Italian pastas to a wide variety of European cheeses. You can visit them online at target.com to find a store near you. Now, we're going to be opening the lines for your calls in a moment. You can reach us at 800-537-5252. But first, I've got the answer to this week's trivia challenge. This one was for the retro buffs. The question was,
Which decade brought us the first salad bar, the first Have It Your Way ad, and the first Starbucks? Well, it was the me decade, the 1970s. Novelist Tom Wolfe created that title, and Burger King jumped on the idea. Never bothering for a moment to consider any of the socio-moral implications, they came up with Have It Your Way. Seattle kicked off today's coffee craze when three locals decided to do a European-style coffee store in Pike Place Market. They decided that they were going to roast their own, actually serve coffee, and sell the beans. And since they were right over the sea, they named the store after a Melville character, Starbuck. The first salad bar was the brainchild of a Chicago singles bar, R.J. Grunts. And the 70s brought us the usual mix of the good, the bad, and the ugly. The first food processor, the first hamburger helper, crockpots, Orville Redenbacher, Chez Panisse, and the Egg McMuffin. Now, if you want to know more, take a look at a new book. It's called The Century of Food by Beverly Bundy. The lines are officially open. You can reach us at 800-537-5252, and we will talk. Okay, let's get right to it. We've got Rick on the line. So, Rick, what do you want to talk about?
Hey, Lynn, nice to talk with you.
Good to talk with you. What is the subject that you want to explore?
Infusion.
Oh, okay.
We were, my wife and I were at St. John last month, and we had the opportunity to dine at Chloe and Bernard's at the Westin Resort. And I normally try to taste mussel dishes anywhere we visit because I just love mussels.
Right.
And they had the most delicious mussels I've ever eaten in my life there.
Yeah.
And it was described on the menu as snapping mussels infused, and it either said infused with or infused in a black pepper, ginger, coconut cream sauce.
Oh.
And so my question is, just the infusion, is that like a really specific process, or is that just like an actual procedure?
Mm-hmm. Infused is one of the very fashionable terms we're seeing now in upscale restaurants. It used to be everything was a confit of something, mm-hmm. and now we have infused, which technically means you take some kind of flavoring or tea and you put it into a warm liquid or a hot liquid, and you let it sit until its flavor has spread into that liquid, and then you drain it away, and there's the liquid. But I think that probably what they did with these mussels is they probably purged them, you know, just cover them with cold water, sprinkle some cornmeal or flour, keep them cold for about 12 hours so that they get rid of any sand they may have. And then what they probably did was they cooked them in that sauce, and okay. that permeated the mussel. Because I can't imagine, unless they were served cold, that you would cook them in the sauce and then let them cool down. That would, in quotes, infuse them, possibly. But I think this is sort of a loose usage of the term infused.
Okay.
Hey, thanks for a great question.
Hey, thank you. I love listening to your show every Sunday.
Well, thank you, sir.
Bye-bye.
Goodbye. You can reach us at 800-537-5252. Sean is calling. So, Sean, what's happening? What do you want to talk about?
I want to talk about miso and how long it will last once it's opened. We have just moved to an area where we would have to drive to Charlotte about an hour and a half to get miso. And we have it and we use it, but once it's open, how long is it going to last?
Ah, okay. You know, this is a great question. Because how many times do you buy things like this?
A lot.
Yeah, and you use them, you know, a few times, and then they sit there for a while.
Exactly.
Okay, let me think. From what I remember hearing about miso, if you keep it refrigerated and sealed, it should last about a year.
No, even once you've broken the seal,
yeah.
if it has like a Tupperware top on it?
Yeah, supposedly it'll last a very long time. You just have to keep it cold.
Wow.
And that, you know, now there's more delicate misos and more robust misos. What color is your miso, if you don't mind? I mean, I don't mean to get personal, but what color is your miso?
The color of our miso is a red.
Okay.
Sometimes it's a reddish orange, and sometimes it's white.
Okay, white tends to be more delicate. Red tends to be a bit more robust. And I think the white may be, you know, figure 9 months. Because
wow.
It's more, isn't that amazing?
That is amazing.
But do seal it well, because miso tends to absorb flavors around it.
Okay, well, that's not a problem. Yeah. Now, a friend of mine was in Italy, and they were making their own miso on an organic farm, and she said that they made chickpea miso.
You can evidently, you know, it's a fermentation process, and I don't understand the entire process, but the miso that we know is generally made with soybeans. But miso can be made with almost any legume, from what I understand.
Wow.
Yeah, and you know, I'd imagine chickpea miso would be very sweet, because chickpeas tend to be wonderfully sweet.
Right.
What do you like to do with miso?
Well, we like to put it on fish a lot, and my husband recently came up with a miso roasted duck with cherry glazed bok choy that we had the other night. It was very good.
If any time you want to cater for the Splendid Table crew, you are more than welcome.
Oh, absolutely. Come on down to Catawba.
Okay. Hey, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Bye.
Bye.
Okay, back to the phones. You can reach us at 800-537-5252. Okay, who's up next? Jan's calling. Hey, Jan, what's up? What do you want to talk about?
Hi, Lynn. I'd like to talk about chocolate.
Okay.
I have a question about baking with chocolate. Are there better kinds for various kinds of baking? And also, can you freeze it? And if so, for how long will it be good?
When you say various kinds of baking, what do you mean?
Well, if you're going to do cakes or cookies or puddings or pies, are there different kinds that are better for these kinds of things?
That's a good question. Basically, when you are cooking chocolate into something, you can use the same style. If you're making candies, okay, which, you know, you're dipping in chocolate and that kind of thing, then you want something called a couverture, meaning something that covers, and it's usually high in cocoa butter. That just helps it have a nice sheen, which also comes from the fact that you temper it. But that's a whole other issue. When it comes to cooking chocolate, what you want is something that has a really intense chocolate flavor. And usually it's bittersweet. And do you want to know brands?
That would be great.
Okay. My favorite brand as far as value for money and really high quality is Lindt. And it's L-I-N-D-T. And they do a chocolate that is 70 or 71%, meaning it's very high in actual chocolate itself. And it's right on the label. You can't miss it. And I think 3.5 ounces is somewhere around $1.79. Now, there's another chocolate that is more expensive. It's a dynamite chocolate. It's called Valrhona. But there, you also want their 71%, because I have found the lower percentages in Valrhona, well, they're good, but they're just not that distinctive. So there are two brands to look for, and both of them are generally in better food stores. Just know that you'll pay less for the Lindt, and it's really good quality for the money. The two brands to avoid are Baker's and Nestle.
Oh, really?
Yeah, because they're inferior chocolate. They don't have the taste. Sometimes they have an off, sort of musty taste, and they don't have the creamy texture.
Hmm.
Yeah.
Thanks so much.
You are welcome, and enjoy.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Take care. I forgot to answer Jan's freezing question. You can't freeze chocolate. I won't even go into why, but you can't freeze it. But if you keep it in a fairly cool place, you know, wrapped and away from light, it'll hold for about a year, and sometimes it'll get sort of a bloom on it. You know, it looks like it has sort of a white bloom. Don't worry. When you go to melt it, it'll all disappear. So you can hold chocolate for a year. Reach us at 800-537-5252, and we will talk. We've got A.T. on the line. A.T., what's up?
Hi. How are you, Lynn?
I'm good. I'm good. What do you want to talk about?
Well, I am looking out my window at the last of my garden crop, which are these stand of probably, 40 or 50 leeks.
You have just saved yourself a bundle. If you went out to buy leeks right now in the market, you're looking at maybe $100 in those 40 or 50 leeks.
Well, they're lovely, but I don't want them to go bad. It's starting to get cold out here on the East Coast.
Uh-huh.
And I was wondering, what's the best way to harvest and store them? And I had two thoughts on it.
Right.
And one would to pull them up and shake them out, shake the dirt off them, and just put them in a box in the garage where it's nice and cool and out of the sun. And the other thought was just to put some hay around them and leave them in the ground.
This is where I wish I had spent most of my life, in the garden instead of at the stove. You know what I'm remembering? I'm remembering some old methods that are similar to your idea with the hay, but that you would put them in what would be called a root cellar, and you would cover them with hay or sand, and, you know, slightly moist, but not wet, and that that would keep them plump, and that would keep them in very good shape for quite a while. I think, first of all, you don't want them to freeze, because if they freeze, then they break down and they get mushy and all that business. Now, if you're in a place where you're not going to have that kind of freeze, I think your idea of really burying them in hay and leaving them in the field is great. If you do the garage thing, I would pack them in hay or in sand.
And slightly moistened, you say?
But very slightly moistened. Yeah, very slightly moistened. And then and make sure the roots are intact. Have you ever tried leek jam, by the way?
I haven't. But we're big jammers out here.
Okay, this is leek jam is really simple. What you want is you take the white part of the leek, which you know how to do. You know, you get all the sand out and all that business by slashing it. And you cut it up into pieces, and you cook it in vinegar and sugar with whatever spices you think you're going to like. So you do like one part vinegar to two part sugar. And you let it cook, and you have a lot of leeks in there.
Yeah.
And I always throw in a nice pinch of hot chili and then cinnamon and a little bit of allspice and salt.
I might not have to store any of these leeks.
You may end up, and this is the kind of thing that's great with things like fresh cheeses on bread, but it's also wonderful to serve with meats or fish.
Wow.
Yeah.
I'll give you one other thing that we do with our leeks.
What do you do?
We bake bread with them. Whatever bread dough recipe we like, we just chop up some leeks, and we put them in to bake with the bread.
Not a bad idea.
Yeah, really nice.
You take care.
Bye-bye.
There's an ugly underbelly to reveling in food. And aside from the belly itself, there are stains. Now, how many pasta dinners have ended up with a whopping cleaning bill? How many times have you dragged a cup through the soy sauce on the way to the sushi? Ah, we have help. Melissa Wagner is a co-author of a new book. It's called The Field Guide to Stains, and we have her on the phone. Melissa, welcome.
Hello, Ben.
Melissa, I've got to talk to you about my personal problem first. If I go out and spend a lot of money on a good silk blouse, it is guaranteed that I am going to splatter it with something like balsamic vinegar and some kind of fat, and the blouse is toast. What can I do? Help.
Well, the thing that you can do, any stain is best removed right away. So as soon as you realize that you have gotten something on your blouse, you can put on some kind of absorbent, especially for those fats that always seem to get us. Put on some talcum powder, baby powder, or even salt. That'll help to absorb it. And then, depending on the type of fabric, you might really just need to take it to the dry cleaner. That might be your best bet, especially for those delicates.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, if it's a sturdier fabric, the best thing that we found is just to use one of those spot stain removers and then wash it in the hottest water that's safe for the fabric.
The hottest water, not the coldest water.
Well, in these cases, for fats and oils, they're best removed with the hottest water.
Huh.
Often, the label's going to tell you what it is that it can sustain. So maybe even if you just spot remove it and then wash it in a colder water.
Mm-hmm.
But the hotter the water for those oils, the better.
Okay. What about soy sauce?
Well, when the soy sauce is fresh, you should force some cold water through the back of the stain because you want to try and get it to come out. A lot of people will just push it in further by rubbing on the top of it, but actually the back of it is the best place to do it. And then always the spot stain remover is the last resort. If it doesn't just come out with water, try some pre-soak and let it stand for a few minutes.
Okay. I'm going to challenge you with some esoteric stains.
Okay.
All right. Mexican mole sauce. Now, what that really breaks down to is it's tomatoes,
fat and chocolate.
Right. Well, for the tomato end of it, you're going to just flush it with some cold water on the back, and then apply the enzyme detergent, rub it in, and let it stand for a few minutes and rinse it in cold water. For the fat end of it, you're going to try, if that's not working, you might need to use a little bit of warmer water. But that spot stain remover really is going to help you.
Okay.
If you end up with something at the end that looks just like a dye, you might sponge it with a mild bleach, like white vinegar or hydrogen peroxide or lemon juice, and then rinse. And I always find that one of the best things you can do is, instead of drying in the dryer, take it outside and hang it in the sun. The sun will actually give a little bit of its own added bleaching. And if the stain still remains at the end, you can still wash it again, and it's not going to be as likely to be set as it would be if you'd put it in the hot dryer.
Okay. All right. What about something like vinegar? Because that's so acidic.
Well, you would apply a base to it. So ammonia actually works quite well, as well as a baking soda solution. You can mix three parts baking soda with one part water and apply that like a paste, and often that will do the trick.
So when you say a base, you mean it's the opposite of being an acid.
Right.
And that counteracts it.
Mm-hmm.
This is why I should have studied chemistry.
It is. It's so much chemistry involved in this.
Hey, thanks a lot.
Oh, thank you.
Melissa Wagner is co-author of The Field Guide to Stains. Well, that's the show for this week. Thanks for listening, everybody. Remember, you can call us anytime. The number is 800-537-5252. And until next week, let me leave you with this old Portuguese proverb. Girls and vineyards are hard to guard. Splendid Table is brought to you by Super Target. Everything you heard here and so much more can be found on our website at splendidtable.org. And be sure to check out the Splendid Table store while you're there. All the proceeds go to support this very program. And don't miss out on our free newsletter. It's called Weeknight Kitchen, and we hope it helps make your weeknight cooking a little easier. Register for it online, splendidtable.org. Our producer is Sally Swift, with help from Jennifer Russell. Our technical director is Jennifer Lubke. The Splendid Table is produced by Minnesota Public Radio and distributed nationwide by Public Radio International. Have a great week and join us next time. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Lynn Rossetto Kester.
Public Radio International.